Rewind, your year in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from Wisconsin Eye's Margaret Farrow Studio.
Hello, Wisconsin. How are you, Wisconsin?
This week on Rewind, we take a look back at 2024, where we'll highlight some of the biggest moments that happened in state politics.
We're sending Wisconsin's favorite senator back to Washington, D.C. for six more years.
Plus, we dive into which issues will dominate political debates in the new year. All that and more during our Year in Review special.
Hi, I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Well, thanks so much, everyone, for joining us to look back on a very contentious and just a very busy political year here in Wisconsin.
So we're going to
it's a never dull moment in this battleground state. And talking about a battleground state really resonates with our number 10 topic, which is the Republican National Convention. We're going to start there because, of course, this was a big deal for the city of Milwaukee, especially after 2020 when Democrats, of course, they had a virtual convention there, but it wasn't all, you know, the shining lights, you know, thousands of visitors, all of that. But this was also a huge opportunity, not only for the city to showcase itself for other big political events in the future, but it was also a way just to get more national attention here. And of course, it definitely did, because we also had a presidential debate as well in Milwaukee in the same arena.
So to me, this makes our top 10 list for the stories of the year because it kind of sets the stage for a lot of other things. I mean, Trump's win now. My conversations with my sources, I'm still skeptical that a convention in a state leads to a victory. Didn't hurt. It also came at this really kind of interesting time in the campaign where Trump was fresh off the assassination attempt in Pennsylvania, came to the stage in Milwaukee with the bandage on his ear, hugged the jacket, right, the firefighter's jacket. I mean, this whole dramatic thing. Now, his speech kind of went a bit longer than people were maybe hoping for at that point in the campaign, but it really sets the stage for a lot of things, the sprint from that moment on, including like Joe Biden dropping out like a week later.
Yeah, it was definitely an eventful moment for sure. Let's move on to topic number 9, which we're going to highlight Derek Van Orden, because he was, of course, reelected. But what we want to dive into is that he was the only incumbent Republican in Wisconsin's delegation that underperformed now from President Donald Trump.
So looking at Van Orden's race, it's interesting because he was never on the toss-up list for any national prognosticator, right? It was always a lean Republican district or a likely Republican district. It kind of moved a little bit away from Republicans as the year went on, mostly because the money that poured in that race. So go back to that primary, had three Dems who ran, Katrina Shanklin, state lawmaker, Rebecca Cook, who ran in 2022. Cook comes out on top, which is interesting because she was the better fundraiser than Shanklin. Shanklin's backers argue that she would be a better fit for the district because she's, you know, experienced as a legislator, a little more moderate maybe perceived. Anyway, Cook wins, raises a buttload of money. Van Orden gets outspent looking at Ad Impact, which tracks ad buys, especially the last 6 weeks. There's an advantage for Democrats, a healthy one. But money is not enough. Like, I know money is the oil or gasoline for politics, but money alone can't buy you a race. You have to have environment, message, candidate quality. Cook looked like a good candidate, had a good message, and Van Orden has his detractors. We've talked about this before in the course of the show. If you look at who's held that seat before in Western Wisconsin, Ron Kind, Steve Gunderson, one Democrat, one Republican, they're kind of more like they do just enough to have bipartisan credentials or show that they're not just like a partisan. I can't think of anything from my conversations with people about Van Orden where they go, yeah, this guy reach across the aisle on this. That doesn't mean they don't work together in anything,
right?
But does he break the party line very often? No. He's a Twitter warrior or ex-warrior, I guess. Mm-hmm. He goes on social media a lot and throws a lot of barbs. So he kind of underperformed maybe because he hasn't garnished that bipartisan credentials, and it brings a question about 2026. Again, if passes prologue, if the party in power in the White House struggles in 26, does that mean there's a chance to beat Van Orden? It's still like a plus 4 or 5 Trump seat. So it's not an easy path, but maybe it's doable unless Van Orden kind of like rights the ship in terms of like his favorability, his appeal beyond just that kind of band of Republicans who alone can probably give him the victory, but would it hurt to expand your margin and make it easier for you every cycle?
Right, and you know, not to you know criticize Van Orden by any means, but when you try to think about some of the big ticket items that he's pushed for or reached across the aisle on, it's pretty slim. It's kind of hard to find that. Now, of course, he's a big ag guy. There's a lot of pieces of legislation that he's proposed related to that, but it's not really in the news cycle, so that could be a challenge for him to try to run on a message in 2 years. But he also is now going into the new year where you have Republicans of full control of Congress and in the White House, so he could have a pretty good rap sheet, you know, to run on and try to heal some wounds for sure. Also worth noting that Rebecca Cook as well, you know, if she does decide to run, which is kind of hinted at in 2 years, she did overperform Tammy Baldwin and Kamala Harris. So she's got that going for her too. So could be fascinating to see what happens in the future. Now we're going to move on to topic number 8. And this is obviously one that I think most people will agree with because it dominated the conversation in 2024. It's immigration and the economy. This was clearly a huge platform for Republican candidates up and down the ballot. It was an issue that President Biden really struggled with, specifically with the economy and how he battled with inflation concerns and prices at the grocery store, which is still top of mind of many voters. They had hoped that the abortion issue would get there, but that's not here on our show because largely immigration and the economy worked well for Republicans.
Well, if you look at the Marquette poll, of course, the year, the economy is number one, which it almost always is. Abortion, immigration kind of like traded spots by a point or two through most of the year. So, to me, it's always about the economy. If the economy is going well, people are happy, then other issues may drive their vote. But if people feel insecure, like they're behind their bills, that's going to be number one pretty much consistently. And I almost kind of raise the question how this race was even that close. If you look at a new Marquette poll that came out, obviously this is post-election and post-Biden pardoning his son, but Joe Biden's numbers are horrible. They're really bad in that poll for adults nationally, how they view President Biden. The economy, Biden was a drag on Kamala Harris. The economy was a drag on Kamala Harris. Now, we can have an academic discussion about the economy and how there's been continuous growth, low unemployment.
Like interest how, rates going down a little bit.
A little bit. How unique that is, that this is, you know, a lot of strengths for the economy, but if you're paying more for eggs, like that's how you view the economy. For a lot of people, it's, okay, what's it cost me to pay my bills? Now, what I'm watching for with Trump in this coming year is, are we paying more for gas and eggs in a year from now? He said in the campaign trail in Wisconsin, I'm going to cut your utility bill in half in less than a year. Now, we all know that Trump speaks in hyperbole quite a bit and goes a little bit maybe afar in what he's trying to say, but okay, what's my utility bill going to be in December of 2025? Will I see a change? Gas right now, not that bad. You know, I saw it jumped a quarter recently, you know, how the Christmas holiday, but is it going to be though $2 a gallon? Because remember, yeah, there's all kinds of fact checks showing that we have more domestic oil production in the United States under Biden than we did under Trump. But it's not us alone. Other regions produce oil. So if we produce more and they produce less, it's still a global economy. Eggs, what if there's another bird flu out there, right? What about the cost of your, that to me is going to be a gauge for Trump when he goes through and says, I'm going to put tariffs on things. Are you paying more or less? And how will that affect voters, right? Are they going to feel like, okay, you promised me less, I was going to pay less, and I'm paying more. How do I feel about that?
Right, and it was just a few weeks ago in the Times article, Trump said that I don't really know if there's a lot that I can do. It's going to be really challenging to get prices down. Well, that was a main message that you ran on. So we'll see what happens in the future. Also on the immigration note, of course, something that he talked about widely about on many campaign rallies about mass deportations. That is a big lingering question heading into the new year. Of course, you hear from people like Attorney General Josh Call and other, you know, legal experts saying, how is this even going to work? How are you going to have the manpower to do this? So there's a lot of unknowns. But even talking to people at rallies, this was a number one issue for them, concerns about border security. So will there be something other than mass deportations? Then that route remains to be seen. But Trump is really kind of getting his arm strength and a lot of bodies into his administration, vowing that they will do this. We'll just have to see how it unfolds.
My impression, if he were to focus on people who've committed crimes first, like that would address a lot of people's concerns. The kind of hazy thing, to your point, is like, all right, if you go after 12 million people, where do they go? Who do you give them to? Just push them across the border of Mexico? That's going to be an interesting situation. So I'm kind of fascinated how that all plays out. And Trump promises a lot, and then the actual details sometimes are not quite what he promised them to be. Will supporters be okay if it's not the full boat of what he said it was going
to
happen?
Right, and could be potentially even legal challenges, as we've heard from some people trying to find ways to block mass deportations from ever taking effect. All right, let's move on to number 7 in our countdown, and that is the record number of school referendums that we saw on the November ballot. We're first going to start with that and then kind of tie this topic into Milwaukee Public Schools and their financial fallout. At the referendums, school districts are now set to collect more than $6 billion. That's a B, mm-hmm. because of how many school referendums that were on the ballot. So this is somewhat of a growing trend that we see almost every single election, JR, that property tax owners are being asked to do more for schools, but in the end, they're always willing to do it. So that's kind of the interesting caveat where, oh no, my property tax bills are going to be higher, but I'm willing to give a little bit more to our kids and their future.
So remember, with school funding Wisconsin, it's not like every district the same amount of money per kid, right? So they locked in numbers back in the early to mid-90s, and then you get a per pupil increase every year. Well, not every year, but most years you get a per pupil increase. And that limits how much you can put in between state aid and property taxes. The more state aid that goes in the formula, less property taxes raised. Republicans were obsessed with property taxes. Well, really, Scott Walker was when he was governor. His entire focus was, how do I keep those property tax bills in check? So they pumped all kinds of state money into the formula, especially with schools. We call it buying down the levy. Like, the more state money in there, keep that cap, that per pupil increase low, that means less money from property taxes. Republicans have found out, though, that's basically walking through quicksand, because as voters approve more referendum, you could put more state money in, try and backfill all of it, but you're always pumping more in. So what's the answer? Democrats keep saying, hey, if we funded schools properly, we'd have this problem. What is properly? Generally, the state superintendent asked for $4 billion more in state aid. I don't know about you with your interviews with leaders, but I didn't find one who said, I want $4 billion more for schools, because that's a huge number.
Yeah.
Okay, so now what? Remember, the governor, with his partial veto authority in the 23-25 budget, locked in that per pupil increase for 400 years. Well, in theory at least, right? We got a state Supreme Court decision coming up sometime soon if that was appropriate. Lawmakers and governor could change that number. They also could fill it with state aid, not property tax increase, but how will they approach that in the budget if there is no change from the Supreme Court, right? Or if lawmakers can't agree on a new number with Governor Evers. So, or Republicans try to say, okay, that increase is locked in, so let's just put some more state money in, meet two-thirds of the increased costs, which is basically our benchmark for Wisconsin for state government, two-thirds of cost of public funding. So would you just do that or do more and try to limit property tax increases? What's the governor going to accept? I mean, that's a huge kind of question for this budget once we see it probably sometime in February.
Right. And the other half of our topic number 7 is Milwaukee Public Schools. Mm-hmm. Like I mentioned, their financial fallout for failure to report certain thresholds of where they were basically at with their funding. And this led to them losing millions of dollars. And there's a lot of still unanswered questions, I would say, about what DPI knew, what the governor knew, all those sorts of things. But bottom line, this was a big mess, mm-hmm. and it's impacted even their superintendent search. State board members even tried to be recalled throughout this entire effort. The public was unaware of all of this. So it wasn't a good look, is kind of the overall about Milwaukee Public Schools, in addition to many other issues that the district has faced over the past few years.
And look forward to the spring. I know it's a year in review, but let's preview 2025. State Supreme Court contest. We've got Jill Unley up for re-election. She didn't disclose this number, this problem with MPS before the referendum. That was approved by, what, hundreds or a few thousand votes, something like that. That might come back to bite her in the spring. So it's at least fodder for her opponents to say, hey, what's going on at DPI and her watch?
All right, let's move on to topic number 6. And that is the state Supreme Court with an open seat on the bench after Ann Walsh Bradley, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, announced her retirement. And so we now know which we now know that there's going to be a hotly contested state Supreme Court race that we have talked about exhaustively already, and it's not even 2025, JR, and that is the matchup between Dane County Judge Susan Crawford and former Attorney General Republican Brad Schimmel. We know there's going to be a lot of issues at stake in this race, but that could really change depending on how many cases and decisions that the court takes up over the next few months as well.
So Ann Walsh Brothers' decision really kind of shook things up quite a bit. Incumbent justices don't lose a lot in Wisconsin. Now, it's happened more frequently in the last 16 years, but 1960-something, 67, a justice lost, in part because he was on the decision to allow the Braves to leave Milwaukee, in part because he was reaching the then-retirement age for justices. It took until 2008 for it to happen again with Lewis Butler, and then 2020 with Daniel Kelly. So if Ann Walsh had run, the theory was she was in pretty good shape to you know, maintain the liberal majority of the court. She's a proven name, been around for a long time, proven fundraiser, all those things are good for incumbent. Now that she's left, it creates an opportunity for conservatives, a better one, to flip the control court back. Now, this is the other thing, too. This spring is, like, really important for conservatives because they lost control of the court in 2023. If they don't win it this year, all right, they have to defend the seat of Rebecca Bradley in 2026, defend the seat of Annette Ziegler in 2027, and then they'd have a shot in 2028 against Rebecca Dow. That's if all three run, they may retire, but you have to, if you don't win this one, it's at least 2028 for your shot again to flip control of the court. The interesting thing is you're talking Act 10 stuff. You know, that's now an issue in the Supreme Court race. We're seeing Republicans trying to say, hey, we won Wisconsin for Trump. We could springboard off of that into the spring. We're super engaged and hyped up. Will Democrats pull themselves up off the mat and say, okay, Harris lost, but and Trump's the president. I got to get back in the fight. Fascinating. $56 million spent in 23. I talked to my sources. They bet more than we spent in 2025, which is mind-blowing in some ways, but underscores the stakes, especially with all the stuff this court did. From redistricting, the abortion cases before it now, there's a lot of big stuff this court's taken on. They haven't produced a whole lot in terms of volume of decisions.
Well, right. In a divided government, we know that's usually where the most controversial issues end up, is in the courts. I don't think the public typically likes that that has to go that route, but that's kind of what happens when you have a Democratic governor, a GOP-controlled legislature. They don't often see eye to eye. So if you want to resolve some issues, let's go to the courts. So let's move on to our next topic, though, JR. And this is about Assembly Speaker Robin Voss at topic number five, because if you forgot, he tried to be recalled. And there was not only just one attempt, there was multiple attempts facing the speaker. And this is a group of kind of Trumpy, I would say, group that have still been very frustrated with the 2020 election, and many of them do believe, which is they have no proof, that Donald Trump won, even though, in fact, President Joe Biden did. This is all growing of their frustrations and their ire for Speaker Voss. Let's first just take a listen, because this was probably one of the most vocal statements that Voss made about this recall effort during a WizPolitics event earlier this year. Let's take a listen.
I did not appreciate the fact that Mike Lindell and all the whack jobs that are associated with this sect of our party were going to spend a disproportionate amount of time and their effort to hire out-of-state recall people, almost all Democrats, to come into Wisconsin and try to get 8,000 signatures in my district. The people who organize this are so out of touch with reality. These people do not deserve the respect that anybody gave them in the media over the course of the last three months. But they literally now believe that I organized the recall and that I went out and found people to circulate it to discredit their efforts. I hope our district attorney will be able to prosecute these people for committing crimes, because the only people that I have seen so far that have committed election fraud are the very people who have done this in calendar year 2024.
Even talking to Speaker Voss this week, he said he went through a lot this past year, because this was an effort that almost seemed to never end. Could it happen again if he decides to run? I mean, who knows? But it's almost something that's just been lingering over him over the past several months. But of course, he was reelected. Things kind of move on. But I don't think these people that have a strong dislike for him are going to go away anytime soon.
So here's the fascinating thing. the legal fight about this is still going on, believe it or not. So remember, the first effort to recall Voss, there was a question of, one, was it possible? The state Supreme Court in December of 2023 said, you cannot use these maps that were in place in 22 ever again. Like, they're out. So the people that she'd recall Voss used the old map to recall him. Now, they were short of the signatures. No matter if it was that district, the new one he's going to be in, they were short. The second attempt, they thought they cleaned up some things and had a better operation and thought they had enough signatures for the district he was elected to in 2022. The Elections Commission, though, ruled that they were short because they had this window to collect signatures. That window ended on a weekend with a holiday on Monday. They kept collecting through Monday and then turned it on Tuesday. The commission said, those can't be counted, therefore you are short. So they sued in Dane County Court. Dane County judge says, look, I'm not worried about whether they have enough signatures. The bottom line is you can't do it because Supreme Court said you can't. They appealed that. They went to the Supreme Court and said, hey, take this case right. The court said, no, we're not going to. They actually filed a request for an extension, or granted one in mid-December for arguments they want to keep making about this case in appeals court. So, you know, it's a moot point. January 6th, new legislature, Voss is sworn into his new seat, can't recall him for a year after that. But they feel like they have something to prove, and they want to go through the courts to do it in the meantime.
All right. Moving on to topic number four, which we kind of already hinted at, is the multiple controversial issues before the state Supreme Court. Some that have been settled, others are pending. First, let's begin with drop boxes, because that was a major 4-3 decision earlier this year that reinstated drop boxes. This has been kind of a point of contention between Republicans and Democrats, whether they should be allowed or not. Mail-in voting overall has been down since the pandemic, but Democrats, a lot of voters with disabilities, believe it's a great opportunity for them to not even leave their vehicle or rely on someone else to drop off their ballot if it's after work hours or et cetera. So there's many ways that Democrats see these as beneficial. Meanwhile, Republicans, on the other hand, have long argued there's no need for them. There's been, claims of ballot dumps, of people putting multiple ballots in there. There's been no evidence of that. But I would probably predict, JR, in almost every election, if they continuously be used in major cities, bigger cities, Republicans are still going to criticize them every time they're around.
So I don't mean to suggest that judges are politicians or that they have their minds made about issues. But I want to highlight a ruling this summer about the stewardship program because it surprised me the breakdown of the vote. We're used to 4-3, right? Four liberals, three conservatives. Some conservatives don't like Brian Hagedorn. He's not really a true conservative. But that said, this summer, 6-1 ruling that struck down how the Joint Finance Committee reviews stewardship purchases. So remember, the stewardship program is one where there's funding set aside in the budget, and for years, the executive branch, the DNR, would submit purchases of a certain size to the Joint Finance Committee for a second review. Rebecca Bradley, the most conservative members of the court, wrote the decision, the 6-1 ruling, saying you can't do that anymore. It violates the separation of powers because you get one kick of the cat. You guys approve the money, the executive branch spends it. End of story. Now, what's interesting looking forward about that program is Devin Lemmy, who told me it's going to kill the program. So stewardship was extended through 25-26. It's about $33 million a year right now in borrowing and spending from other sources. If there's no mechanism for lawmakers to have a check on those purchases, they're not going to renew it. So something to watch going forward tells you the impact of a decision. And again, unique, that was 6-1. And two, there's a real-world impact going forward of like, okay, what to watch in the budget? Will they do anything with that program going forward is going to end it.
Right, and also a case before the state Supreme Court right now is Governor Tony Evers' 400 veto related to school funding increases. This was also probably an issue that we saw justices on both sides really question, in a sense, what is the limit then with the governor's veto powers, which are still some of the most extensive in the entire country. But over the last dozen or so years, they've been chipped away at. So this is something where we might also see maybe a 5-1, 6-1 decision on. We'll see. But let's just hear a little bit from some of the justices on that veto powers issue real quick.
I think that there is concern that now we've got this 402-year veto. It does feel like the sky is the limit. The stratosphere is the limit, right? And perhaps today we are at that fork in the road. I think we're trying to think, like, should we today in 2024 start to look at this differently?
We have a kind of a mess. I mean, I think if you took any person who was around when this amendment was adopted, they would be shocked. There is, which is why when legal scholars and others who look at what we do in our body of case law, and they think it's crazy, because it is crazy. We allow governors to unilaterally create law that has not been proposed to them at all. It is a mess of this court's making.
All right, let's move on to topic number three, which is JR's favorite topic. That's why it's in the top three, which is redistricting. Of course, this was a huge issue and basically a huge win for Democrats this year. As we saw in November, under the new voting maps, Democrats picked up 10 seats in the state assembly, 5 seats in the Senate, 5 key seats that were pretty contentious, too. And this is creating a new path forward, is what you hear from lawmakers on both sides. Before we kind of dive into this, what I thought was probably most fascinating about this whole debate is that many Republicans voted for Evers' maps because they didn't like the alternative, right? If this would have gone to the state Supreme Court, the biggest fear from Republicans is that they would have drawn more favorable maps to Democrats. So we're going to hear from Senator Dewey Strobel on the floor kind of talk about that, because it kind of put them in a pickle. But also what was interesting is you had a lot of Democrats vote against the governor's maps. So let's just take a listen to some of the floor action earlier this year.
I'm going to vote for these maps, because the process that's underway in the Supreme Court certainly doesn't appear that it's going to take our arguments seriously or even consider them. So we kind of have a gun to our head, frankly, is really how it's looking right now.
You can claim all you want that this is the governor's map, but it's the governor's map with some extra language added. And so now we're left with uncertainty about the special election in the 4th, uncertainty about the Voss recall, uncertainty about any future special elections that might come up.
To me, the decision to enact these maps boils down to this. I made a promise to the people of Wisconsin that I would always try to do the right thing. And keeping that promise, to me, matters most, even if members of my own party disagree with me.
So this created many more competitive districts, which I think in the coming years, you know, you talk to Democrats and say, hey, this is going to put pressure on Republicans that maybe we should get more compromise. We can get more things done, because you got to go back to your district and say you got something done.
Well, I mean, like, the RNC set the stage for a lot of stuff. Like, to me, this sets the stage for a lot of things that happen with the legislative races. You could argue we should have Democrats picking 4 seats in the Senate as a top 10 story by itself, or Republicans maintain the majority in the assembly, despite the mass, as a top 10 story by itself. But to me, this process set the stage for both things to happen. And so with this, go back to the debate about the new maps. Democrats were, like, left and right, were worried that if we vote for these things and they're signed, Republicans will challenge them somehow. Unfounded, they didn't challenge them. So, you know, there's always a chance to challenge them later on, but that didn't happen. Republicans were worried that they might lose the assembly. Turns out, and I saw all kinds of copy from conservatives, like, oh, these maps are, you know, pro-Dem. They're going to, like, lead the Dem. Turns out you have to have a good affirmative top of the ticket for Democrats win the assembly. Mm-hmm. That didn't happen. Trump winning by less than about a point shows you where the map is at. Plus, the assembly, Republicans overperformed in Dean Coffert, former state lawmaker, won his old seat, the 53rd in the Nina Menasha area. Jesse Rodriguez won her seat in the Milwaukee area, suburban Milwaukee. Overperformed there again, like she often does. Todd Novak in Dodgeville, he overperformed. So it shows you that it's not just about a map. It's message, it's money, and it's candidate quality. Democrats had the money. It was a tough ask to go from 34 seats or 35 seats to like 50. On the one hand, the maps are better for them. But you have to have candidate recruitment. You have to have staff. They're not used to having that many campaigns to run, mm-hmm. to be honest with you. Infrastructure, like, yes, we have a state party on both sides that do doors and have phone banks, but Democrats aren't used to competing. Some of these places are competing in now. Like, it's a new ball game for them.
Find people, right? There's not that huge interest as much anymore. That do you want to run for office?
And it's for Democrats in the assembly, especially. It went from, okay, your best bet is to avoid a superminority in the Assembly or Senate and, like, protect Evers' veto. Now, there's, okay, we might be able to win. And Diane Hasselbein told me that she went to bed, like, Wednesday morning after the election, got about an hour of sleep, and the calls began that morning. I want to run in 2026. Now, it's one thing to want to run. It's another thing to actually have the fire in the belly, they call it, have the message, the background. So they got to find the right candidates. But if you look at the four Senate seats up in 2026 that are sort of competitive, one's held by Jeff Smith, a Democrat. Devin Lemmy, who told me this week he expects Jesse James, a Republican from Altoona, who was drawn into that seat to run for that one rather than the one he was elected to in 2022. That makes that kind of competitive, two incumbents. But still, all four seats, Kamala Harris got more votes than Donald Trump, even though it was a good year for Republicans. If it's a good year for Democrats in 26, that likely is good for Democrats, although Howard Markline, down in southwestern Wisconsin, runs with the top of the ticket, great fundraiser, so watch that. Now, the Assembly, 11 seats that were closest, they were split fairly evenly. Democrats got to sweep all 11 that were within a couple of points to have 50 seats come 26. Unless they can find a way to make Shana Zimmerman up in the St. Croix area or Representative Moses, him competitive, they both won by like 6 or 7 points, 8 points this fall. So they weren't truly competitive seats. Unless you add more to the list, you've got to keep all yours in that top 11 and sweep theirs. Again, doable, but a tough task. Unless it's a good year for Democrats.
All right, and I talking to Representative Greta Neubauer this week, she took it as even before the November election, she thought the new maps that were going to be in place, of course, for that election, were already working because she pointed to things like shared revenue, the deal for AmFam to keep the brewers here in Milwaukee but also fix operations in the future, like upgrades and whatnot. And she says, you know, they wanted to have something to go back to their districts during the campaign season and say, look what we did, especially shared revenue, right? Like, who can't argue I got more money for our municipalities when it comes to police, EMS, libraries, other critical services funded by shared revenue? But she believes, too, now that we have these new maps going forward for the next decade, she believes that, you know, there could possibly be more willingness from Republicans in competitive districts that they want to also reach more compromise on big ticket items. Now, will that be tax cuts? Who knows? Mm-hmm. But they want to get at least something major accomplished to have that and go back and campaign on, and then, you know, over the next 2 years. Will that become a reality, JR? I think that's a big question, because I think your answer is no.
I'm skeptical.
A little skeptical. All right, let's move on to topic number two. And now we're going to be looking at the November elections, because Senator Tammy Baldwin narrowly secured re-election for a third term. Of course, she made her victory speech few days after she won because her opponent, Republican Eric Hovde, refused to concede for almost over a week, and there was a possibility of a recount. In the end, she was up by 29,000 votes. Let's just take a listen from her victory speech before we move on.
The way we won this race is the way I've always approached this job, and that is we did everything, everywhere, all at once. I travel to red, blue, purple, rural, suburban, urban parts of our state. I listen to people. I really listen to people. And then deliver for them. And in turn, these Wisconsinites showed up for me.
A request for a recount would serve no purpose because you will just be recounting the same ballots regardless of their integrity. As a result, and my desire to not add to political strife through a contentious recount, I've decided to concede the election. One thing is certain. I will always fight for the country and state that I love and work to restore the American dream.
This is, of course, topping the charts of our countdown because she won despite Vice President Kamala Harris losing Wisconsin. And it just goes to show that Baldwin has a platform that really works for her. And it's a lot of the key rural areas. She's got the rural vote. And she's just been in office for so many years. She got name recognition, things that she also talked to many reporters after the election. She believes that Harris just couldn't do in a matter of 110 days that she had to build her campaign on. Credit to Baldwin for winning, and once again, Wisconsin being a split ticket, which is so rare here.
Well, we've talked about pretty much the entire cycle that perception was Tim Walz could run above the top of the ticket. The question was by how much. Now, when Joe Biden's on the race, it was like, this is going to get tough because mm-hmm. Biden was really struggling before he dropped out. So was 3 points possible, four? Like, it was like, oh, that gets... Turns out that a point about as far as you can go in Wisconsin and out on top of the ticket. Now, granted, 6 years ago, Baldwin outran Tony Evers by 10 points, but that's a different environment. You're talking about a governor's race versus a U.S. Senate race. When you've got the president and the U.S. Senate race on the same ticket, same, that's a tougher task to kind of run well ahead. So Trump wins by 30,000, rough 29. Tammy bought 29. Some factors to consider. Hovde was not happy about Thomas Leaguer, this America First candidate, claiming that he was the reason that Hovde lost. Now, if you took every Leaguer vote and gave it to Eric Hovde, he'd still be short by a few hundred votes. You talk about white knuckle, you know, recount territory, but still wouldn't be enough. There was a Libertarian candidate on the ballot. Well, he's a Libertarian who ran under, like, Disrupt the Corruption banner. And Republicans said, well, he cost us the election, too. Okay, well, you're not guaranteed a two-party vote. You're not guaranteed, not like you can say, you can't run for office. I shoot all your votes because you're not voting for Tammy Baldwin. So, bottom, my point then is, Eric Hovde had problems. His favorability is upside down, last Marquette poll. There's a reason why those guys did not vote for Eric Hovde, those voters, because there's no doubt that Eric Hovde was Donald Trump's guy, right? They campaigned together, Trump endorsed him. Whether it was the wealthy banker ads that we saw in the course of the campaign, whether it was, you know, the hits about Hovde's stuff he said before about people overweight or people in nursing homes, like whatever, they were turned off by Eric Hovde. Still, very close race. He did much better. People thought he would do like in August. July and August, he looked like he was really in difficult shape. Even until late September when Natural Always came in with a big media buy, that flipped the switch. Everything changed after that. You saw a ramp up of the ads on transgender issues with Baldwin about her partner and questions about financial conflicts of interest. So my question now for Baldwin is, okay, you survived this one. What next? I mean, 6 years is forever away from now. Not asking if she's going to run again already, but will it change her approach, change her tone? Will we see her run for a fourth term in 6 years? Or do you say, okay, that was enough. I've done my time with this job.
Right, and also when you get elected to another six-year term, you can also already see things where maybe you don't talk about that, but she seems to be have a little bit more willingness. Mm-hmm. Even just, you know, with Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy, things like that where she's supporting him, other things you might not just want to talk about. So you kind of can have a little bit more risks to the job when you are reelected for that long because you're not running reelection.
They spent $235 million on ads, and I will bet you, I'll guarantee you, a year from now, her name ID will drop, which is crazy to think about, but U.S. senators get forgotten about. It's every 6 years. Mm-hmm. We cover them relentlessly, but for the public, you fall out of the public eye. Now, same thing with Ron Johnson. Every 4 years, so he wins. 4 years later, his numbers are down in the 30s again. So where's Baldwin going to be at? Where's her starting point for 6 years from now?
All right, and drum roll for our number one topic is President-elect Donald Trump winning. Of course, here in Wisconsin, but picked up many key battleground states back in November. Also interesting to note, there was always thresholds that we pay attention to, JR, here in Wisconsin. Can he reach, you know, 23, 24, 25% would be an ask here in mm-hmm. Dane County, but he did overperform in Dane County. He really won over white college-age students, not even here just in Wisconsin, but nationally. That helped him in a big college town, deep blue college town here in Madison. He also didn't perform as well in some of the WOW counties, but in a sense, he didn't need to. Yeah. So it's this fascinating formula that he was able to create in a battleground state, which you can never know what the outcome is going to be, but of course it was a close one.
I never thought I'd see a Republican win statewide in Wisconsin below 59% in Waukesha County. He did. How he did it was he cut into the margins all over the place and maximized rural Wisconsin. Now there's this myth nationally that Milwaukee had a drop-off in turnout. Election day, it didn't. It actually, not at all. But Harris had fewer votes in Milwaukee than Biden did. So it wasn't a drop-off for overall turnout. It was fruit people going, I want to vote Democratic this year. Trump picked up about, 3,000 votes there in his raw number, netted 6,000 total in Milwaukee. Okay, there's one piece. You're talking about Dane County. Maximize out state. My question, though, is for Republicans, was this a Republican win or a Trump win? Because going forward, are you going to get college kids in La Crosse to vote for Brad Schimmel for Supreme Court this spring? Are they going to turn out for the gubernatorial race in 2 years? I don't know. But we do know they turn out for Trump. Like, he is the attraction. So for Republicans, do you build around that formula going forward? Do you bank on, from now on, not getting 59% in Waukesha County? That's dangerous.
Yeah.
And why I say that is, when I started doing this, every spring election was favored conservatives, generally speaking, because older, whiter, more suburban electorate. Well, those folks more like what Democrat than they were 20 years ago. They also turn out every year. No offense to blue-collar workers, a lot of my family, but typically they don't vote every election. They are every four-year voters. Okay, well, we have elections like every year, it seems like, in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Okay, so spring. How do you capture that Trump crowd in Wisconsin? Now, Turning Point USA, which was a pro-Trump youth organization, younger person organization, they're talking about doing stuff in Wisconsin. I've seen other conservative personalities on social media say we're going to help with Brad Schimmel. But what's the motivation for a college kid to turn out for Brad Schimmel? Now, okay, we talk Act 10, right? So there's a court case there. Go tell Act 10 to 21-year-olds. I'm not meaning to diminish 21-year-olds, but say, hey, what's Act 10? What are they going to say?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, like, is that a motivating factor for them? Now, Trump, prices, abortion, okay, get that. I'm wondering what's the form for Republicans going forward, how they piece a coalition together, and can you keep the Trump coalition going? That's going to be fascinating to watch for Republicans, because they're on a high right now. But as I've often said, the pendulum always swings in politics. The question is how fast and how far does it swing back? So will we get our answers? Is it starting to swing already? What's going on in D.C. with all this stuff about the King resolutions and spending? Are we starting to see the first signs of, okay, too much drama?
Well said. All right, that will do it for our very busy year in review. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
I hope you have a happy new year.
This program was brought to you from Wisconsin Eye's Margaret Farrow Studio.
Rewind, your year in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.